Today at Reader's Corner, Adam Higginbotham, author of Challenger, a true story of heroism and disaster on the edge of space. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. On January 28, 1986, just 73 seconds after liftoff, the space shuttle Challenger broke apart over the Atlantic Ocean, killing all seven crew members. Millions of Americans witnessed the tragic deaths of the crew, and like the assassination of JFK, the Challenger disaster became a defining moment of 20th century history. In his new book, Challenger, A True Story of Heroism and Disaster on the Edge of Space, Adam Higginbotham paints a compelling tale of ambition and ingenuity, undermined by political cynicism and cost-cutting, and the ensuing investigation, driven by leakers and whistleblowers determined to bring the truth to light. Adam Higginbotham's work has appeared in The New Yorker, Wired, Smithsonian, and elsewhere. He is the author of the award-winning book, Midnight in Chernobyl. Adam Higginbotham, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Adam, this is the home of Boise State Public Radio, Boise State University, where the teacher in space, Barbara Morgan, landed after her space flight in 2007. She was, of course, the backup to Krista McAuliffe. Barbara has done an incredible job here at Boise State of introducing students to NASA, many of whom have had career opportunities there. She even attracted another astronaut, Steve Swanson, to come to Boise State, and he's continued his relationships with NASA. Maybe we could begin, since what most Americans remember about the Challenger, and there's plenty of other things to remember, as we'll get into in a moment, but let's begin where most Americans are thinking. Krista McAuliffe, let's talk about the Teacher in Space program. How did this come about? And in reading your book, I even learned that there were going to be some other programs like this. And good old Walter Cronkite, who I listened to for many years and watched, was one of the anxious ones trying to get in line for a flight that, of course, never happened.
That's right. Cronkite was one of the leading candidates to be the first journalist in space, which was going to be the follow-up to the Teacher in Space program.
So what about the Teacher in Space program? This was, to some extent, I guess you could call it a public relations move to engage more people in the space program, would you say?
It certainly was a public relations move because, you know, NASA had always, as an agency, being concerned that if they didn't maintain a lot of kind of keen public engagement with the space program, with the manned space program in particular, then, you know, they would lose ultimately congressional support and congressional funding. So right from the beginning of the space program, the agency was really concerned that they needed to keep doing things that would keep the public interested in spaceflight. And, you know, that became a particular concern in the wake of the moon landings. When, you know, after the initial landing in July 1969, public interest in spaceflight really began to fall off quite precipitously, you know, to the extent by the time of the final manned landing, you know, people were phoning in to TV stations to complain that they were missing their regularly scheduled programming and soap operas. So when the announced intention of the space shuttle program, which was to make crewed spaceflight a routine process that would take place with the sort of regularity and ease of flights on a jet airliner, when the space shuttle program began to succeed all too effectively in that role, and the takeoffs and landings of the shuttle began to seem routine, public interest in the shuttle began to fall off. And so NASA wanted to come up with some way of re-engaging public interest in the program. And so the idea was conceived of a citizen spaceflight program. So they wanted to engage regular people. They wanted to take regular people on the shuttle, which seemed like a perfectly reasonable idea at the time, because instead of having to fly on the shuttle in this kind of, you know, bulky pressure suits that you'd seen during the Apollo and the Mercury years, it was designed as a shirt sleeve environment. So all of the astronauts who flew on the shuttle in the early years, you know, went up in T-shirts and nylon flight suits. They didn't have these pressure suits. And there were a lot of initial studies done at NASA. You know, they outsourced consideration of what kind of citizen astronauts they could engage to do this first. And James Beggs, who was the director of the administrator of NASA at the time, you know, had his own ideas. And so they considered a really wide range of people to begin with. Beggs himself was keen on sending a boy scout. They considered a photographer from a magazine like National Geographic, for example, who could capture their own view of what was going on. And before they arrived at the idea of the teacher in space, which would help reach an audience of children, especially, which Beggs was very keen on doing because he thought that there'll be no better enthusiastic audience for spaceflight than children. They did embrace some fairly peculiar ideas. My favorite one of which is that they initially considered sending Carol Spinney, who was one of the puppeteers on Sesame Street, who was the puppeteer inside the Big Bird costume.
Oh my gosh.
And NASA did actually enter into correspondence with Spinney and ask him if he would be interested in going up into orbit as Big Bird. And Spinney replied in the affirmative. He was all too keen to do it. And it was only because they eventually figured out that the costume itself would not respond very well to being in weightless conditions that they eventually decided that this wasn't going to work out. But otherwise, the first citizen astronaut could have been Big Bird.
Unbelievable.
So in the wake of the failure to get a puppet from Sesame Street into space, they then turned eventually to thinking that a teacher would probably be the best candidate to reach the widest possible audience and to engage the greatest number of people. And so Beggs sent this idea over to the Reagan White House. And as it happened, Ronald Reagan was in particular need of winning the support of teachers unions at the time with an election year coming up. And so they announced in 1984 that the first citizen astronaut would be a teacher. And Christa McAuliffe ultimately proved to be the teacher who was selected from around 11,000 applicants in what amounted to a months-long sort of talent competition.
11,000? Yeah. Wow. So Barbara Morgan was the elite few there, I guess, coming in second at first, but most importantly, emerging as one who eventually did go into space.
Absolutely, yeah.
So you open your book with the date of January 27, 1967, when a fire broke out in the Apollo 1 space capsule while it was on the launch pad. Three astronauts were killed. How did things unfold that day? Or maybe we don't have all the time in the world that you have to tell the story in your book, but maybe just the backstory of that disaster that sets up what could go wrong much later with the Challenger.
Yeah, I mean, the reason that I opened the book with that event is really because, you know, certainly at the time it happened, the Challenger accident was widely perceived as this kind of, you know, one-off event that revealed unexpectedly how profoundly dangerous human spaceflight was. But the truth was that you know, it had been this dangerous all along, and that the public had discovered this really for the first time in 1967, when there was this fire on the launch pad during a countdown test for Apollo 1, which would have been the first manned capsule launched from Cape Canaveral in the Apollo program. And it had its roots in similar sort of disregard for the warnings of middle-ranking engineers and, you know, what engineers at NASA eventually came to refer to as go fever, which was the idea that you would just kind of press forward with your expectations and program to launch, and that any problems that arose along the way, you could just fix as you went. And it was just better to get things going because, you know, you're under a lot of time pressure, and any engineering faults that you discovered would just have to be cobbled together and fixed along the way. And one of these problems was revealed quite early in the Apollo program when they began to think that their plans to have the Apollo capsules pressurized with an atmosphere of pure oxygen when it was on the launch pad could be potentially problematic, because it meant that if there was so much as a single electrical spark inside that closed pressurized environment, a flash fire would take place, which would almost immediately kill everybody inside. And that's exactly what happened in January 1967. There was an electrical fault inside the capsule, and the hatch design of the capsule made it almost impossible for the astronauts to escape before they were killed.
Which is a different kind of ending for the Challenger, but we'll get there in a minute. Let's talk for a moment about this idea of seven crew members leaving home that morning, going to the office, let's say. But the subtitle of your book says it all, A True Story of Heroism and Disaster on the Edge of Space. I mean, this is a most courageous move for anybody who's going to space, way different than going to the office, as I said. Bob Kustra here, speaking with Adam Higginbotham, author of Challenger. The book is a thrilling minute-by-minute account of the 1986 Challenger shuttle disaster based on new archival research. So could you just collectively or individually run through what this crew looked like in terms of their competence, in addition to the competence of the teacher, Krista McAuliffe?
Well, that's, you know, Bob, that's one of the reasons that I wanted to write the book in the first place, is because, you know, I realized that over the years since the accident happened, the other six members of the crew, aside from Krista McAuliffe, their stories and their experience had really been sort of overshadowed by McAuliffe's story. She was the sort of the headline grabbing member of the Challenger crew at the time, which was, you know, NASA's idea all along. And the other six members of the crew were lesser known at the time, but in the years since, they've really been almost completely forgotten. But each of them had these extraordinary stories and these extraordinary pathways to the launch pad that morning. And it was also remarkable because it was the most diverse crew in NASA history. You know, the pilot and the commander, Dick Scobee and Mike Smith, both fitted the sort of stereotypical NASA test pilot profile in a certain way. They had both been fighter pilots. They were both combat veterans. They were both, you know, 6 foot white men. But the crew also included Ron McNair, who was the second African-American in space, Ellison Onizuka, who was the first Japanese-American in space, Judy Resnick, who was the second American woman in space. And then there was also Greg Jarvis, who was also a civilian, although he came from a space technology background, because he worked at Hughes in the manufacture of communication satellites. So they were, it really was a kind of remarkably diverse group of people. And, you know, they had, similar to the 11,000 candidates that Krista McAuliffe had to beat out in order to get to the launch pad that day, you know, they themselves had been through an extraordinarily rigorous selection process.
Your book does an excellent job of digging down into the details of what went wrong. I wonder if you could just share with us generally, what were the warnings on that morning about a failure, but of course they were ignored?
Well, the most immediate and kind of glaring warnings pertain to the weather, because it had been established the year before that the seals in the solid rocket boosters, which were the two 150-foot high, 12-foot diameter rockets that provided the shuttle with most of its thrust to take it into orbit, the seals that held the segments of those rockets together were, the engineers who built them suspected, quite susceptible to failure if the weather got too cold, because the seals were made of a sort of artificial rubber substance that became very stiff and inflexible if it got too cold. And there had been a launch on which Ellison Onizuka had been a member of the crew in almost exactly a year before, in what was at that time the coldest weather in Florida history. And one of the engineers who worked at Morton Thiokol, the contractor that manufactured the rockets, when he did a post-flight inspection, examined the what remained of the seals of the rockets, and began to think that the leaks that he had detected in the seals had been a result of this cold weather. And so at that time, then he, you know, sent warnings to his superiors. He ordered up tests to find out exactly how badly affected these seals might be if it got too cold. And they set in train a series of changes and redesigns that they wanted to do in order to fix long-standing problems with the seals. But this engineer, Roger Beaujolais, was eventually satisfied that, this was regarded as a once in a 100-year weather event, coldest weather in Florida history. The chances of that recurring again, before they'd successfully redesigned the joints and fixed the problems that they suspected were causing these leaks, seemed minimal. And so Beaujolais, was satisfied that it wasn't too dangerous and that they should go forward and continue flying the shuttle, regardless of the leaks that he'd detected. And then a year later, he was sitting in his office when, on the morning of January the 27th, the day before the final launch, when he heard about the weather forecast from Cape Canaveral. And once again, apparently, it was going to be the coldest weather in Florida history. So he could hardly believe it and was absolutely aghast to hear that they were planning to launch under these circumstances. And Beaujolais and his superiors at Morton Thiokol then pressed to have the launch postponed until the weather warmed. And that was the first of the major warnings that they had that ultimately was disregarded. And the launch went ahead just before noon the following day.
So when you refer to the seals, are those the infamous O-rings that we've heard so much about, or is that yet another problem?
No, that's
Yeah, okay.
exactly what we're talking about.
Yeah, that's what I thought. And there's been quite a bit written about that particular aspect of the flight. So the Challenger explodes, but when I read your book, I was surprised to learn that it didn't turn out like I thought it did. I mean, when I looked at that explosion, I just figured that was it for the 7-member crew. I'm going to let you pick it up from there, but apparently it wasn't it. And that would be learned in the sea later on.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, because anybody looking at what happened from the ground at the Cape that morning or on TV and that infamous footage that was replayed over and over again from the minute it happened onwards for months afterwards, would see this kind of blooming fireball into which the shuttle disappeared and did not re-emerge. And it would be easy to imagine that the entire orbiter, which is the part of the shuttle that's the part that looked like like an aeroplane, was just immediately incinerated, and that fireball killed the crew instantly. And in a way, NASA kind of allowed that belief to continue in the public imagination for a long time after the accident happened. But that actually isn't what happened, and people within NASA who were conducting the investigation realized that quite quickly after the investigation into what happened began. Because the truth is that the fireball did not incinerate the orbiter, but the orbiter was torn apart by the aerodynamic forces bearing on it as the rest of the shuttle stack, the external fuel tank, and the solid rockets began to come apart during the course of the accident. And while the shuttle itself was torn apart by those aerodynamic forces, the crew compartment was a sort of separately contained, pressurized structure within the fuselage of the shuttle. And that emerged intact from the fireball and continued flying upwards close to its original trajectory until it reached its apogee and then began falling back towards the surface of the ocean. And the investigators examining the wreckage that they discovered on the seabed afterwards realized that the forces that were bearing on the crew compartment as it came free of the orbiter weren't sufficient to kill the astronauts. And may not even have been sufficient to render them unconscious. And their investigation of the wreckage they discovered on the seabed also revealed evidence that it was entirely possible that at least one member of the crew remained conscious for the almost 2.5 minutes it took for the crew compartment to fall from its apogee to hit the surface of the water.
Adam, I remember your reporting in the book the possibility that the crew could have had a different kind of equipment that might have saved them from their deaths into the sea. How's that?
Yeah, that's true, because the space shuttle was the first crewed spacecraft in NASA history that did not have any means of escape for the astronauts during the ascent phase, because it was essentially too complex and too expensive for them to install what they had originally envisaged, which were various different rocket-assisted escape systems. But they certainly intended to have those originally, and until budget restraints essentially meant that it was impossible. But had they had any sort of escape system like the ones that they had had on the Apollo rockets or the Mercury rockets, then because they were apparently able to survive the disintegration of the spacecraft, they may well have been able to return safely to Earth even after the shuttle itself had come apart.
And the families of the crew members were eventually able to have some closure because of the fact that there were bodies to be returned.
There were parts of bodies to,
right.
Because the impact with the ocean essentially destroyed, shattered into pieces, not only the crew compartment itself, but everything in it. Mm-hmm. But they conducted a months long operation to locate as much of the wreckage as possible and to find the crew compartment and recover the remains of the astronauts. And they did do that. So yes. Mm-hmm. And they were ultimately all returned to their families.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Adam Higginbotham, author of Challenger, a true story of heroism and disaster on the edge of space. So let's talk about the role that President Reagan plays at this stage. He creates the Independent Presidential Commission on the Space Shuttle Challenger accident. It's going to be led by William Rogers, who's a former Republican Attorney General and Secretary of State. And there's 12 members. Give us an idea of who these members are, and especially the late Richard Feynman, who was just a rock star in the physics world and has a lot to say about this accident.
Yeah, well, the Rogers Commission was made up of 12 different individuals from across the military, scientific, and spaceflight world, and included sort of a number of celebrities from their own background. So it included Chuck Yeager, who famously is the first man to break the sound barrier, Sally Ride, the first American woman in space, Neil Armstrong, and Richard Feynman, who had become particularly famous at that time for the first time because, in addition to all of his achievements as a scientist, he had recently published his first memoir, Surely You Were Joking, Mr. Feynman, which had become a bestseller and made him, as you say, a sort of rock star physicist. And he was, famously iconoclastic and just prepared to speak truth to power, really. And one thing I did discover during the research of interviewing, surviving members of the commission is that many of the other people on the commission couldn't stand Feynman because they just thought that he was this kind of showboating character who was a loose cannon, who was out to get himself in front of TV cameras and boost his own public profile as much as anything else.
Well, he actually did he convinced the chairman to allow him to do some kind of a mini experiment, didn't he?
And this is taking over
the commission.
So Feynman's ice water experiment is actually a particular, this was a particular turning point in the way other members of the commission regarded him, because what he did famously was the hearings of the Rogers Commission were televised and watched by millions of people live in the same way as the Nixon hearings had been not long previously. And there was this very famous moment where, in order to demonstrate the way in which cold temperatures might have an effect on the O-rings that had sealed the solid rockets, Feynman got a small sample of the artificial rubber that was used in the O-rings and put it into a glass of ice water on the desk in front of him. And then during the hearings, during questioning, pulled it out and showed that it had become very inflexible. If you bent it over, it wouldn't. If you bent it over on itself, it wouldn't flex back to adopt its original position very quickly. And so this was an extremely visible and easy to understand demonstration of the limitations of these O-rings. Mm-hmm. But what particularly incensed some other members of the commission was the fact that they already knew this, and the investigators themselves had already revealed that this was a fact. But almost immediately, in the public mind, Feynman became the person who discovered this. And, without Feynman's amazing discovery that he demonstrated in front of the TV cameras, then the commission would never have successfully identified the proximate cause of the Challenger accident, didn't happen at all. But one of Feynman's particular gifts was being able to simplify complex scientific concepts for the general public. And, he demonstrated that gift once again with his ice water experiment, even though it wasn't really an experiment and he didn't discover this phenomenon in the O-rings. That moment really kind of solidified a certain part of the investigation in the minds of the American public.
I'm running out of time for questions, but I do want to give you an opportunity, Adam, to address those who really came to the rescue of this commission in getting to the bottom of it, getting to the truth. And I'll mention Al McDonald. You can say a word about him. And then there was also two men at Morton Thiokol who spoke the truth, and they were punished. But in the end, it worked out all right for them, I guess you could say.
Well, I mean, that's one of the reasons for the subtitle of the book, you know, about why it's a true story of heroism and disaster. And because, you know, some people say, well, were these astronauts really heroes? Because they didn't even make it into space. And of course, on one hand, you know, absolutely they were, because it took enormous courage, even for those members of the crew who had never flown into space before, you know, simply to climb aboard this spacecraft that they knew was extraordinarily dangerous. But on the other hand, the other heroes of the story are these people, including Al McDonald and particular Roger Beaujolais, who was one of McDonald's subordinates at Morton Thiokol. And between the two of them and with these other engineers that you mentioned at Thiokol, you know, had they not come forward and revealed what they knew about this debate about whether to launch or not on the eve of the disaster, the real truth about what happened might never have emerged. And McDonald and Beaujolais had both done everything they could in that 24 hours leading up to the launch to try and stop the launch going ahead. And both of them, having failed to do so and to have done everything they thought possible to try and save the lives of the astronauts in advance, you know, both of them were deeply traumatized in the wake of what happened. And in fact, they were punished by Morton Thiokol. Both of them were removed from their responsibilities in the immediate aftermath of the Rogers Commission hearings when they had disobeyed the clear wishes of their corporate superiors and come forward to talk about the fact that they had both recommended against launch. And then the Thiokol managers had reversed their own engineers' recommendation and given the go-ahead to launch.
It's an incredible story, well told by Adam Higginbotham. And I want to thank you, Adam, for joining us today at Reader's Corner. We couldn't begin to tell the entire story. And that's why I want to strongly recommend the book, Challenger, A True Story of Heroism and Disaster on the Edge of Space. Adam, thanks for writing it. And thanks for being with us today at Reader's Corner.
Thank you, Bob.
Now, since you did Chernobyl and now this disaster, is there another disaster you're working on, or can't you talk about that?
I don't know. I mean, I'm pretty reluctant to write about another another catastrophe of the kind of scale of these two, because it's just I must admit that I found this one more difficult to write about and to research than the Chernobyl accident. I think because at the time it happened, it had much more of a profound effect on me personally. Whereas Chernobyl was obviously much more remote.
For all of us.
Whereas the Challenger accident, you know, I remember it clearly. And so I found this quite a hard book to write. And so that has made me somewhat reluctant to return to, you know, any subject that might involve me spending a long time talking to orphans about, you know, the worst.
Yeah, I know that makes a lot of sense. Well, wherever you land, we would look forward to having you back at Reader's Corner, and I appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you. I'd love to do that.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is James Baker, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.